Okay, turn with me this morning to Exodus chapter 21. Exodus chapter 21, Moses is continuing his narrative concerning God's giving of his moral law to the Israelites on Mount Sinai. In addition to the Ten Commandments, the Lord also presented the Israelites with various ordinances, various regulations intended to govern their everyday personal relations. Now, before we get into the text, let me just state again that these ordinances are not necessarily in the same category as the Ten Commandments. In other words, while some of them might be reflective of God's expectation for righteousness among His people for all time, there are others among these ordinances that appear to be only relevant to the time in which they are written. They're only relevant with regard to the Israelites themselves. And this is not anything unexpected. It's not anything uncommon. This would be the equivalent of God's civil law for the Israelites. Now, there are a lot of things that we can take away from these various ordinances and regulations by way of practical application. And we're going to see that even in our time together this morning. But this is one of those places in Scripture where we are not to take everything according to the letter of the law. As I've said before, if we begin our foray into God's law as it pertains to His ceremonial and civil law, we need to understand that only the moral law exists in perpetuity for God's people for all time. The civil law was meant to serve a particular purpose. The ceremonial law was intended to serve a certain purpose. And we shouldn't confuse those things with God's moral law. Some people do that, and that's why people think that it's biblical to entertain dietary restrictions and things like that. Those are things which were established for the Israelites, but they were never intended to carry over in perpetuity for obvious reasons in some cases. So, anyway, verse 1, begin reading with me there. Moses writes, "Now these are the ordinances," this is the Lord talking again to Moses, "these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years." You can already see the irrelevance here for us, right? "If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he's the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man,' then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door of the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently." Okay, now just stop there. This is precisely the point I was making about these ordinances being intended for a particular people at a particular time and not binding on believers perpetually in other cultures or at other times. Thankfully, most advanced cultures, especially those founded on Judeo-Christian principles, we're no longer in the business of buying and selling our fellow human beings. It's also not common for men to be given wives by their employers. At least I hope you're not in a job where your employer is giving wives out. So again, this particular ordinance as it stands is just not applicable on its face to believers today. That said, though, we're still left with the question of how God could possibly condone, much less govern how it's done, how could He condone slavery? I think we have a profound misunderstanding here of the culture and the times in which these things were written. In Hebrew culture, it was not uncommon at all for Hebrews who could not support themselves to be brought on as servants or slaves to other Hebrews. We need to understand that the slavery here is not the kind of slavery that God delivered the Israelites from in Egypt. It's not the kind of slavery that the Israelites would again find themselves under during the Babylonian exile. This is not a cruel, harsh brand of slavery. The slavery spoken about in this passage, the slavery that God very much condones and administers in a very important way to Moses, this kind of slavery is not at all unlike the employer-employee relations that we live under today. And you might protest. You might think, well, I'm not a slave. Well, you are, right? Every one of you who, in one respect or another, have not, you're working for someone who has. You're dependent on that person to do an honest day's work for an honest day's wage, and you have a covenant with them. You are under agreement with them to abide by their principles, to do the work that they have enlisted you to do. And if you don't do the work that they've enlisted you to do, or you do it not up to their standard, then that arrangement will be severed by them. So it's not at all unlike the employer-employee relationship. The thing that we're reading about here is God expected there to be a modicum of fairness on both ends of this spectrum. In other words, every slave was given a contract. This is a contract. And bear in mind, most of the slaves were those who willingly sold themselves. These are people who had no income. These are people who had no prospects for their futures. 99.9% of them actually placed themselves in the job market. And they would be purchased by other Hebrews of more substantial means, and they would be given a contract. And that's what this is all about. The slave shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh, he can go free. No more payment. There is also a hint of what we would later define as indentured servitude here. I don't know how many of you have relatives that came over from England, Europe. A great number of them, including my own relatives, were brought over from England and Europe to the New World. They were brought here by people who could afford to pay their way. My relatives, back all the way back to the 1600s, could not afford their own passage from the Old World to the New World. They just couldn't do it. So what happened? Well, they signed themselves up for indenture. In other words, they approached another individual and said, look, if you'll pay my way over there, when we get there, I will serve you. Normal indentures lasted or were intended to last between 4 and 8 years, the average being about 5 years. You would work for the man who paid your way to come here, and in recompense for that, you would pay off that debt. Now, the problem is, we're talking about men who sometimes have nefarious motives. We're talking about men who are unscrupulous, men who brought you over on a 5-year indenture only to find out 15 years later that you're still indentured to this person. Because written in the fine print of these contracts, these agreements, were things like if you ever need to borrow something, and there have been reports of people who would borrow an egg from their master, that's another year on your indenture. They would borrow firewood. You know, those who had indentured servants knew that they had the upper hand, and they knew that if they could keep their indentured servants dependent on some level, they could just keep racking up the years. It was really, at that point, forced slavery, because legally you could not get out of an indenture unless you could either pay your way out or serve your time without any additional time being added. The Hebrews were a lot like that. God is setting parameters up for them to avoid their being mistreated or mishandled. God says 6 years on the job, the seventh year, they're free. They have to be set free. And again, I think it's a wonderful thing that God is doing here within the system that had already been established by the Israelite. And again, basically a conciliatory system, right? Don't think of their slavery as the type of slavery that is oppressive. Now, in some cases, I'm sure it was. Some of you have really bad bosses, right? Or you've had really bad bosses. You're not going to escape man's natural tendency to mistreat his fellow human beings. But in most cases, again, this type of indentured servitude was perfectly acceptable to most people, slaves and servant, or slaves and masters as well. Now, what if a man came in and he was married? Well, if he was married and chose to take his wife with him, that's fine. What if the slave gave him a wife, or the master gave him a wife? What would happen then? Well, I mean, you got to think the wife that he gives the slave is also a slave. He's not going to give this woman to this man with the prospect of losing her however many years later it would take for him to fill his 6 years. And so God says, you know, I can't do that. That would really create a disruption in the workforce. So in events like that, any woman that is given to the slave by the master to be his wife, any woman and her children would stay behind. You want to leave me? You married the wife I gave you? Then they're going to stay, right? But God also created a very generous provision for the family to stay together, right? Now, how did he do that? Well, if a man was given a wife by his master and he wanted to stay, which again is a pretty sure indication that not all slaves were mistreated. There were a lot of slaves, like God himself tells Moses. What if he says, I love my master. I love my wife and children. What then? Well, he can get tenure. Just put your ear on the doorpost and we'll put an awl through it. If you don't know what an awl is, it's a really long pointy thing that they use to make holes in leather. Yeah, ouch. I mean, you think going to Claire's for an ear piercing's bad. You know, at least they're not putting your ear down on the doorpost with a big awl, you know. That might be a good business opportunity for Christian families. Steve, let's look into that. We're going to start a ear piercing company. No, let's don't. Yeah, James. Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, you know, God made this wonderful provision for families to stay together. You know, and if the man wants to stay, the master was to bring him to God. What does that mean? Bring him to God. That's a bad translation. How many of your translations say bring him to the judges? Good. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the King James who has bring them to the judges. That's a much better translation. The reason God is used there is because in the Hebrew, the word Elohim is used there, but little e Elohim was also a word used to describe the judges, the legal system, the powers that are subordinate only to God himself. And so you were to bring this man before the judges. Why? Because a legal contract was drawn up. Not only was the ear-piercing ceremony had, but they would draw a contract up saying, here's your papers, you now belong to so-and-so, no one can ever buy you again, he can't sell you, you're his forever. And there were a lot of relationships like that, where slaves understood that if they were to leave at the seven-year point, what were they going to do? Probably sell themselves to another slave. Well, why do our master? Why do that? Why sell yourself to another master when the master you have is perfectly good to you and has been? So again, it's not the negative thing that many of us, tragically so, associate slavery with. Now, before we move on to verse 7, let me just add this as well to lend more weight to the idea that this was, in fact, more of an employer-employee arrangement than how we actually think of slavery. Look at Deuteronomy 15. Deuteronomy 15. If you don't already know, Deuteronomy comes from two words. Deuteros, which means what? Second. Right? And namos, the law. Deuteronomy is really nothing more than Moses' retelling of how the law was given with much more detail. The second iteration of his narrative about the giving of the law. And in Deuteronomy 15, 12 through 18, this same incident is recorded, but with some really helpful additional insight. Read it with me. Deuteronomy 15, 12. If your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free. When you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally from your flock and from your threshing floor and from your wine vat. You shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this day, it shall come about if a person says to you, I will not go out from you because he loves you in your household, since he fares well with you, then you shall take an awl and pierce it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your servant forever. Also, you shall do likewise to your maidservant. It shall not seem hard to you when you set him free, for he has given you 6 years with double the service of a hired man. So the Lord your God will bless you in whatever you do. You get that? Not only was the man to be allowed to leave at the seventh year, God expected the master to provide him with a severance package. That's not slavery as we understand slavery. None of this is. This is God's way of making sure the Israelites, all of them, from the poorest to the richest, had some part in this society that was to be very orderly and God-honoring. And this is why God is making these provisions. One commentator said this. He said, some think that the Bible is responsible for slavery. You ever heard that before? A lot of people blame slavery on the Bible. A lot of schools that ban the Bible, they ban the Bible in complete and utter ignorance because they insist that the Bible promotes the kind of slavery that we had in this country in the 18th and 19th centuries. They couldn't be farther from the truth. In most cases, that kind of slavery is condemned by God. That kind of cruel enslavement of image bearers of God is always repudiated by God Himself. This is not that. But this commentator says some think that the Bible is responsible for slavery. The opposite is true. Slavery existed long before Israel or Moses. The Bible is responsible for the elimination of slavery, not its establishment. The ideas of man-stealing and lifelong servitude, the concepts many have of slavery, simply do not apply to the practice of slavery in the Old Testament. Normally, slavery was 1, chosen or mutually arranged, 2, of limited duration, and 3, highly regulated. Highly regulated. Spurgeon's also helpful here. He said, the slavery which existed among the ancient Jews was a very different thing from that which has disgraced humanity in modern times, and it ought also to be remembered that Moses did not institute slavery in any shape or fashion. The laws concerning it were made on purpose to repress it, to confine it within very narrow bounds, and ultimately to put an end to it. I think that's really helpful insight. I think it's insight that's often missing in a lot of people's arguments about the nature of slavery during this time. Well, going back to our text, if you continue at verse 7, The Lord's not done yet. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, what kind of man would do that? A poor man. A man who wanted her to have better opportunities. Right? Simple as that. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she's not to go free as the male slaves do. Whoa. What do we see there? God's a chauvinist. God's a misogynist. God hates women. Is that what we're reading there? No. What do you read there? Yes, God loves women. God protects women. Even in a culture where women were seen as chattel, God does not see them as chattel or possessions. God sees them as those who need to be loved and protected. You see how silly it is sometimes? The lens that we see things through is very important. This is why presuppositions are so important. If you presuppose that this is the kind of slavery that we fought to eliminate in the world and are still fighting in some instances to eliminate in the world, then you've got it all wrong. This is God-sanctioned employment. This is God-sanctioned servitude. If she's displeasing in the eyes of her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. Now, what does that mean? If she's ugly, he can kick her to the curb. Is that what it's saying? No. It has nothing to do with looks or anything. See, again, the lens that we view these things through is very important. Be careful that you're not viewing these events through the lens of modern history. We've all been programmed to one degree or another that things like this are patently evil. What does it mean if she's displeasing in the eyes of her master? It just means that if a master secured a slave for himself, either as a personal servant or perhaps even as a potential wife, or, as was also allowed during this time, as a concubine. Now, that's very distasteful to us today, but it happened back then, right? God just hadn't gotten around yet to making clear the importance of this concept of one man and one woman. It was established. It was that way from the very beginning. It was exemplified in Adam and Eve. These are some of the sins that God overlooked or winked at for a time, because he's in the business here of developing his redemptive plan. We can't expect God to have come on the scene and completely turned everything on its head. How do you think that would have worked? It wouldn't have. You think people would rebel at that point if everything all at once was changed? That's why smart politicians today use a gradual approach to enact their ideas, to enact their plans. It's politicians who come in, like someone that will remain unnamed, who immediately undo everything that was done by the previous administration and expect to be popular for it. No. That gives your constituents and others whiplash, does it not? God's the same way. God takes an incremental approach, both in his revelation. Notice we don't go right from Egypt to Jesus. We're going through a long, slow, drawn out opening of this aperture where more and more and more and more light is shown until man can accept all of these radical changes. Now, this is radical enough, the changes that are being instituted here, but kind of have to wrestle with the fact that concubines were still a thing, right? Not yet dealt with. Does that mean that God approved of such things? No, not necessarily. But he's saying if you're going to engage in this type of thing, if a man as a master is displeased with the woman that he designated for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. In other words, he can just let her go to another master, right? He does not have the authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her, Notice what God says. It's unfair to her. You shouldn't have chosen her to begin with if you thought that she might be displeasing to you in any way. So the Lord's not going to make her suffer because of his unfairness. So you're not going to be able to sell her on the open slave market, which could have been disastrous for her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. What does that mean? It means very simply that if he designates that this woman would now be married to his son, arranged marriages. Don't be surprised by that. Arranged marriages were a thing until the early 20th century. All over the world. Right? Even in rural Appalachia? Yes. I mean, all kinds of cousins, right? To marry. You think I'm joking? No? West Virginia, most of our family trees just have, you know, one branch. It goes straight up. Oh, no. No, we're good people. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. There it is. There's the concubine part of it. In other words, he can't neglect her physically if he's taken her on in this fashion. And now he's displeased with her. No, still got to be good to her in every way. If he'll not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. This is what happened most of the time. You need to know that too, because even by this point in time, concubines were reserved for the uber wealthy. It was not something a man was really wanting to do, take on two women as in the wife configuration. So most of the time, the man would say, you're free to go. You're free to go. And if he couldn't have her redeemed by someone else, at the very least, she didn't owe him anything, right? So again, this might sound really strange, but we need to understand the differences, I think, between what are cultural norms today versus when these things were written. So, let me ask you again, why would a man ever think of selling his daughter as a female slave? I mentioned the fact that it would provide her security, and that's true. That's true. There are a couple of other reasons, though, as well. Loving fathers, especially those who knew honorable masters, who treated their slaves well, they would sell their daughters because it would benefit them also, not just the father, it would benefit him, but it would also benefit the daughter in many more ways than just financial security. It would give her kind of a new station in life. There was really nothing more pitiful than a man or a woman who was in this on this lower rung of poverty, who no one wanted them, no one would purchase them or employ them, no one would take care of them. These are the very ones that Jesus talked about when he says in Matthew 7, you know, to those who say, didn't we do this and didn't we do that? When Jesus refers to the least among the brethren, he's talking about those who have no prospects, no chance for upward mobility. And so this was really a very gracious thing for God to set in place. Go and find these people and help them if you're able, right? In many cases, these young women would marry their masters or serve as their concubines, but if the master, again, found her displeasing, she could be either redeemed or put to use in other ways. Should the master find another woman to be his wife? Again, he was not to allow that to affect the woman he purchased beforehand. He was to take care of her with food and clothing and even in the area of conjugal rights. Children, if you want to know what that is, ask your mom and dad. So, before we move on, let me just stop here because there's a lot written here, but not very much that we might consider to be practical or applicational. And this is one of those cases, yet again, where I insist that we slow down and read this very slowly, process it, and ask the Lord to reveal to you what types of things might be applicable even in my own life. You know, Paul did say to Timothy that all Scripture is breathed out by God and it's profitable for all those things, for correction, for reproof, for training in righteousness. While not as obvious as many of the most applicable passages in Scripture, what Moses writes here has been preserved for us in large measure to ensure that we better understand and appreciate who God is. Now, how does this passage do that? Well, first of all, think of all the perfections that are demonstrated about God in this passage. Among those, we see His sovereignty. And again, it's an odd place to find God's sovereignty, but here it is. Moses, for all intents and purposes, is the appointed leader of the Israelites. Aaron, his assistant. They have been given all the orders. They have been keeping everything together by God's grace and at God's direction. But this is one of those early opportunities for God to demonstrate His sovereignty by coming in and telling Moses, "Moses, tell the people that God has said." What does that constitute? Well, it constitutes an inviolable standard. God says, do this. Do it and live. Don't do it at your own peril. So it's a demonstration of God's sovereignty. The duty of the Israelites is to abide by these ordinances for no other reason than that God said to. Now, what else do we see here by way of God's perfections? We can see His righteousness. If we say, and we do often in this place, whatever my God ordains is right, then it includes things like this. What we see here is a demonstration of God's righteous standards. God says, I am righteous. If you would be my people, you will also be righteous in your deportment and in your behavior. Well, how do we do that in this current system of servitude and slavery to one another? Here's how you do that. And you do it again because it's right. This is the right way. What else do we see? We see His justice. There's great justice revealed here. God is a just God. We see His fairness in this. God insists that image bearers of Himself be fair to one another. Treat one another fairly. That's the whole, you know, seven-year thing. If the slave wants to leave after 7 years, let them go. And oh, by the way, give them a severance package. Make sure they don't leave empty-handed. Why? Because that's a way of you showing that you appreciate the work that they've given you. You know, I think of things like Downton Abbey, right? And the people who work downstairs. You know, that's, by the way, another picture of what we're seeing here. You know, you had an extreme case, especially in Victorian England, you had an extreme case of the haves and the have-nots, the upstairs, downstairs people. You know, and the downstairs people worked at the behest of the upstairs people. And so you can see this even playing out well into the 20th century in an otherwise very civilized country. What else do we see here? Well, we see God's compassion, don't we? God is compassionate. You know, God could have very well taken the stance, you know, the hardline stance, if you don't work, you don't eat. He could have said, well, you know, if you're among the haves, then lucky for you. If you're not, then you can expect a short life. But God's compassionate. He's telling the haves, take some of these have-nots. And put them to work and be fair to them and be good to them. And should they love you back, that's the whole concept here, should they love you in return, then make them yours forever. What's more compassionate than that? Do you not know you and I were bought with a price? Compare what God is foreshadowing here to the work of Christ in delivering us from the slave market of sin. God took us and enlisted us. This is why we are also called slaves of Christ. He pressed us into His service, much as God is insisting that the Israelites do for one another here, not in a salvific way, but certainly in a compassionate, fair, just way. The Lord Jesus Christ took us even to the extent where He put the awl through our ear. What does that mean? He made you His own forever. Aren't you glad there's no statute of limitations on God's grace? Aren't you glad God didn't say, well, yep, you've been mine for 6 years. I'm going to put you out. Try again. No. This is why the doctrine of adoption is so precious to us. Well, we continue at verse 12. And I want you to think about what we're reading in these terms that we've just talked about. Here the Lord continues saying, "He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die." Now here's where we have a parallel to what the Lord mandates here in our own justice system. This is an abiding principle, namely because murder is a violation of the sixth commandment. That's why this particular ordinance is in fact intended to go on in perpetuity. The principle is to remain. Even before the sixth commandment was given, man had been instructed that the taking of another man's life would result in the forfeiture of his life as well. Genesis 9:6. Remember that? "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God He made man." God says, "These are my image bearers. You will not kill them. And if you do, you forfeit your own life." This is that eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth principle that serves as the basis for capital punishment. Right? Now, should we be all fans of capital punishment? Yes. In a perfect justice system, yes. But guess what? Sometimes man has axes to grind, does he not? Sometimes the justice system, not sometimes, now it's like all the time, the justice system is incredibly unfair. I'm all for capital punishment. All for capital punishment. But only insofar as it can be proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that that person is guilty. Otherwise, the state is just as guilty of murder as the murder they're accusing perhaps that innocent man of. We got to be very careful. You know, again, we live in a soundbite society. We live in a world where everybody is out to get each other. Cancel culture, politically correct. You know, all we know of most issues is based on the, you know, 30-second snippet that we've heard on Fox News. We need to be very careful that we understand that innocent people can be and are put to death by the state because there's just not enough evidence, but there is enough bias against that person for whatever reason, racial, economically, associationally. Got to be very careful that we don't jump on the bandwagon and insist that every person who's accused of murder gets put to death. You better have proof. I mean, how many of you would want that on your conscience? That you put an innocent man to death This is what makes me so nervous about... I love jury duty, by the way. I'm one of those really weird people. But only when it concerns things like traffic tickets. Right? The thought of me being part of a group that condemns a man to death, if there's good evidence, I'm all for it. But again, sometimes you're going to be that 12th person that doesn't see the evidence. Sometimes you're going to be the 12th person in a group of 11 other biased, prejudiced people who insist the verdict go one way, and you're going to lose on that. Anybody want that on your conscience? I don't. Anyway, God sets up parameters to ensure that even murder is handled judiciously. What kind of murder exists even in our own jurisprudence today? Well, we have first-degree murder. First-degree murder is usually premeditated murder. Means I intend to do this. Going to go out and do this because I don't like that person and they should no longer exist. We also have second-degree murder. Second-degree murder is, there's a fine line between second-degree murder and manslaughter. Second-degree murder is generally, I killed this person, but I might not have intended to kill this person. Manslaughter is, this person died as a result of something I did, but I didn't mean to do it. Right? God has provisions set up for all of those cases. And again, it's a wonderful demonstration of the meticulousness of God when it comes to understanding how certain things play out among us. Turn to Numbers 35. Numbers 35. I didn't get my Bible. In Numbers 35, beginning at verse 9, we read this. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select for yourselves cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there. And the cities shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger, so that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. And the cities which you are to give shall be your six cities of refuge. You shall give three cities across the Jordan and three cities in the land of Canaan. They are to be the cities of refuge. These six cities shall be for refuge for the sons of Israel and for the alien and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there." What's that an example of? It's an example of God's grace. You kill somebody unintentionally, people are going to come after you. You need somewhere to go. These six cities of refuge were established so that people would have a place to go and be protected. Now, we're not told exactly, but we can only assume that there were various safe houses, safe locations, where people could be put up until trial, at which time their case would be adjudicated. So, we have these cities of refuge for people who kill unintentionally, but again, what happens if you kill somebody intentionally? Well, if you kill somebody intentionally or presumptuously, you're going to forfeit your own life. Really is as simple as that. Look at 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 2. Notice here that God says, even if the intentional murderer is at the altar, you're to drag him off and put him to death. I mean, that sounds kind of messed up, doesn't it? Even if he's at the altar, you need to go and get him, put him to death. 1 Kings chapter 2, just to set this up, you'll recall Solomon has had several people killed for their lack of loyalty. Among them was Joab. When David was on his deathbed, you'll recall that Joab conspired with Adonijah to install Adonijah as the next king instead of Solomon. This was treason, right? By the time we get to verse 28 of the passage, Adonijah's already been executed for his treason. And now it's Joab's turn. And what happened when Joab got wind of his own impending execution? Verse 28. Now the news came to Joab, for Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. And Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. Why would he do that? Because he assumed that would be the only place they wouldn't actually come and get him. He said, I'm going to go and I'm going to grab the horns of the altar. If you don't know what that is, altars were like flat tables with these things on each corner called horns that I guess were meant to not let the sacrifice roll off. I think they had other religious purposes as well, but you get the idea. But he ran into the tabernacle, I guess, or the temple at the time. He grabbed the horns of the altar and he said, you know, nanny, nanny, no boo-boo, you can't get me, right? Pretending to worship, I would imagine. And what happened? It was told King Solomon that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord. And behold, he's beside the altar. Then Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go fall upon him. So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, thus the king has said, come out. But he said, no, for I will die here. In other words, if I let go of this altar, you're going to kill me. Right? And Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, thus spoke Joab, and he answered me. The king said to him, do as he has spoken and fall upon him and bury him. He said, he's going to die there. Make it happen. And bury him so that you may remove from me and my father's house the blood which Joab shed without cause. The Lord will return his blood on his own head because he fell upon two men more righteous and better than he and killed them with the sword while my father David did not know it. Abner, the son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa, the son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood return on the head of Joab and on the head of his descendants forever. But to David and his descendants and his house and his throne may there be peace from the Lord forever. Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and fell upon him and put him to death, and he was buried at his own house in the wilderness. God meant business. Even if you're hiding in a safe haven, unless God has declared it to be a safe haven for you, which in the case of intentional murder, there were no safe havens, even the temple, the tabernacle, even the altar itself was not a safe haven. You take another man's life, you die. And note again, Joab's crimes were well documented. I mean, Joab was a scoundrel. He was used mightily of the Lord in many times, many cases. But when he sided with Adonijah, he went a bridge too far. When he conspired to have Adonijah put on the throne instead of Solomon, God would not abide that. God had made his intent known, and God would see to it that his purpose would be carried out, even if it meant dragging Joab off the altar and killing him on the spot. You know, there was a time in this world where punishment was a deterrent, right? You think about the border situation, and you wonder, and I'm not getting political here, but you wonder why in previous decades, I mean this decade and the one before, it's just been a mess. You wonder why people just didn't break into countries without going through the legal channels. Why did they not do that? Well, because there was a penalty to be paid. You come across the border back in the, I'm telling you, children, back in when I was a child, you try to bum rush the border. Especially in numbers like are coming over now, there'd be a lot of bodies laying on the ground. And people knew that, which is why they didn't come across in the fashion that they're coming across now. I mean, you want an interesting study? Go to Europe. Try to cross into Hungary or Romania. or Poland. And I'm talking about previous Soviet bloc countries. But strangely, they're the ones who today are getting it right. You can tell, and just look at their economies, right? Their economies are thriving now because they're doing things like that the correct way. They are a nation of laws. They are nations of laws, and they use the threat of punishment as a deterrent. Imagine that. Punishment is a great deterrent. That's what God's doing. God's saying, you know, if you're going to go out and kill one of your fellow image bearers of God, and you're going to do this unscrupulously, you're going to do this intentionally, then you got to know you're going to die too. Right? Murders are at an all-time high today because there's no penalty for it, except sticking you in prison for the rest of your life and giving you, you know, three hots and a cot. I mean, who wouldn't, and a library and a television and ping pong and racquetball and weightlifting, and who's in? Huh? That's right. Free education. Anyway, I said I wasn't going to get political. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The world's gone crazy. I'm just here to tell you. Anybody see the lines at TSA and the airports around the country? You and I have to take our shoes off and be wanded and patted down and strip searched and, you know, and the illegal aliens just, they don't even go through TSA. There's no screening. Just get on the plane. Yes, James.
Didn't God pronounce something like this on Israel as part of their crime? The stranger will become the head.
Yes.
The other end.
Yeah, and many times we see that. We're going to see that in our Old Testament studies. You know, Israel was taken into captivity in Babylon for what reason? Yeah, but what was the big exile? What was the reason? Disobedience. Yeah, they stopped worshiping the one true God, if they ever started. But again, all these things point to God's goodness, God's fairness, God's justice. And by extension, all of these things point to how we should be treating each other in an orderly and God-fearing society. So, well, Lord willing, we're going to continue our study at verse 15 next Lord's Day. Let's go ahead and close.